This is the Cyber Union Talk Show for Monday, November 14th, 2011. Music and movements. This is Stephen from occupied Boston, Massachusetts, and joining me is...
Walton in Glasgow, Scotland.
How's it going there, Walton?
We're okay. I mean, there's been a few technical issues again tonight. I think I'm on my third PC. I've been having annoying problems. Part of the reason, I think, is because we suddenly used Skype tonight for reasons which will become apparent later. Yeah. I suddenly had to find something which would play nicely with Skype. So, but everything seems to be up and running and going okay. So we have a show.
That's true. And I hope our free software advocates out there don't kill us for this one. But you'll certainly understand as later in the show, which will be fun to do. So on my side, a bit excited because I've got less than 3 weeks to go until I actually jump ship, I guess you could say, from the U.S. And move to Guatemala. So a lot of things have been going on, and I'm excited to start learning Spanish at the school, El Migrante Spanish School. I'm a bit nervous, but it should be fun, and we'll see how this developing a enterprise of sorts, a worker-run enterprise at that point, is going to go. I might actually have to listen back to our Mondragon episode just to remember the pointers that I need to go over. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit nerve-wracking. Yeah, so is anything else exciting on your end over there?
Oh, there's lots of stuff happening all the time. Big student demonstrations against the cuts, all sorts of upheaval, Occupy movement still going well. The movement is growing, and it's still strong, and I hope that we can continue to contribute to it in our small way.
Yeah, definitely. And before we get to the show, I just want to do one really quick tech update on things, just some stuff that I've learned here with the Occupy in Boston, if you don't mind if we jump into that really quickly.
Jeffrey.
So one thing that I had heard about, and I don't know if we discussed this at another point, but you know, we use Google Docs when we share our notes for the show, and find out that the software running it is called Etherpad. And mm-hmm. It's something that Google technically owns, but they released it as free and open source software, which was pretty cool. So I found an instance of it that is done by riseup.net. They have it's pad.riseup.net, where you can actually go there and see the very, very similar feel and interface to the Google Documents. It's not everything and not all the same features, but you see kind of the backbone to it. And there's been some discussion with Occupy Boston's tech working group to try to use the pad for a number of different working groups pages that we've been putting together on the Occupy website's or Occupy Boston's website. So after finding it, I just started playing with it and thought it was a pretty cool little tool that I just want to touch base on and keep some of the tech going within our tech and labor discussions that we do all the time.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at it right now, and it's we're using it to share notes about the show, and it's very easy to use, very effective, and very much like Google Documents. So, great.
Pretty cool. And I guess on that note, I think we could probably keep our updates a little bit short today, since our interview is going to go probably a little bit long, I imagine. So without further ado, let's just jump into the interview section. Joining us on the show today is David Rovix, who I came about knowing from a friend of mine named Douglas, who's a host of the Music Manumit show. And Doug has known that my choice of music has been a lot of folk artists such as Pete Seeger, work done by Woody Guthrie, Utah Phillips, and Billy Bragg. And when he told me about some of the work that David has done, I hadn't heard the name, and I was kind of surprised I hadn't, given how much I'm into folk music. And when I went and checked out his music, I was overwhelmed with it, and really excited to see a real modern folk artist performing really amazing pieces that are connecting with a lot of different social movements. So I want to take the time, and just we're going to get the chance to interview David today, and I want to thank you for joining us today, David.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Walton, there was some events going on in Scotland that I think there was a bit of a connection that David had, didn't he?
Yes, there was, actually. I think we spoke on the show previously. There was a big student occupation at Glasgow University. The Hetherington Research Club was occupied, and it became known as the Free Hetherington. Anyway, David Rovix came and supported the occupation and performed for the students, and they absolutely loved it. And one of the students was a member of our union, Unite, and he wrote an article for the Unite website and talking about how fantastic it was to have David performing in Glasgow. So it's fantastic to have him on the show.
David, if you don't mind, what was that experience like when you were in Scotland with the student occupation?
It was wonderful. You know, it's always such a pleasure when there's some militant activity happening when I'm in town rather than when I'm out of town and hearing about it. And I don't know if I want to say it's a good coincidence, but in any case, I was there when the police raided the place and arrested everybody and one morning. But then people started marching around the university and the crowd started growing, which is always nice when a march actually grows instead of shrinks, you know, which, you know, is always an indication of something good. And it grew to several hundred people, if I recall. And then folks went and took the Senate building instead of the Hetherington, which was sort of upping the stakes a bit because the Senate building was actually being used, unlike the Hetherington at the time. So then basically the administration started negotiating after some other, you know, some bit of police brutality. And then, by coincidence or not, it was like 10 minutes after we had just loudly sung my song Burn It Down on the porch of the building that the administration sort of offered to give everybody the old building back if they would leave the building they had just occupied. It was a darn good day of entertainment.
Well, I wish I could have been there.
David, you've been around for some time because I remember your songs from the anti-globalization movement of sort of around the year 2000. That's when I first came across your music. So, it's really encouraging to see that you're still going strong and still providing a soundtrack to social change.
Oh, it is. It's a fun job. You know, it's lucky to be able to do it.
Well, that's great. Well, I guess we could move from one student occupation to what is going on. I guess I can't even say here in the States anymore because it's now becoming global, which is the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
Which is quite exciting. And so have you been to the camps here in the States?
I've been to 18 so far in the U.S. and in Canada and done little sort of informal, sometimes slightly pre-planned concerts in most of them. And it's just been great, and it's an exciting movement that's happening. It's really got caught hold of a lot of people's imaginations, and there's a real sense of optimism. A lot of new people involved who have never done any kind of activism before, and it's the most diverse and broad-based movement I've seen in my lifetime in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And it's affected the discourse and the media. I mean, it's really, it's had an impact on people around the world, because it exists, basically. It's been great. And it's been great to happen to have been on a tour that was pre-planned and then to be able to participate in the movement because it's everywhere, you know. It's not like you have to cancel your plans and go to some other city. It's like all the cities you go to, there's something happening. So I was doing two shows a day for weeks.
Oh, <that's... laughs>
one was the show that was pre-planned and the other was at the local occupation.
I think that's one of the nice things about the occupying movements is that there's always space for a show, talks and everything else, which is really just inspiring and great to see actually happening. If you don't mind me jumping onto that, going from there, David, which is the song that you'd actually just recently written and haven't professionally recorded yet, but the Occupy Wall Street song. For listeners haven't heard it, I'll definitely put a link in the show notes for them to hear. Which I thought was really well done. And what I think is really touching about it is that it hits the stride and hits a chord that I think is really strong. And it's a matter that it's calling for this occupation not to move, in the sense of not to move from the space that you're at and to keep growing into other spaces. And I just want to thank you for such a great song, and just wondering what your thoughts were when you were trying to write that song and putting it together.
Well, I know that in all the different I guess a few things. One is that I think the tactic, which is to hold space until your demands are met, among other things, that's a key part of the tactic, was, shown to work, very effectively in many different cases, but especially in Tunisia and in Egypt in recent, in the past year. And so I wanted to just write something that really reaffirmed that tactic as a really good tactic. And then also to, you know, participate in the debate in some small way in terms of, like, because there's always some people in different occupations who are saying, you know, that maybe, you know, we should be more cooperative with the authorities or whatever, and move to, you know, some other space. And of course, there are practical considerations involved with moving indoors. I'm not saying people shouldn't do that in terms of, like, dealing with the cold or whatever, you know, to occupy indoor spaces too. That's great. But basically to say something that's supporting the notion of more, you know, militant action in terms of, you know, nonviolent civil disobedience, occupying space as people are doing, you know, just to kind of put in my two cents, and also to respond to the media's constant saying, like, what are these people, you know, think they, these people don't know what they're doing, or they're not inarticulate, or they don't have a plan. And of course, you know, there isn't necessarily a unifying plan for people who have a problem with 1% of the population owning half the wealth. That's a big problem that affects a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. But I thought I'd list at least a few dozen reasons why people would want to do what people are doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's really great. I think it's very encouraging and strengthening. I think the most impressive part is that it keeps growing, and I just think that there's a moment and an opportunity that exists that could keep growing, and not, like, I guess the constant thing I always hear, maybe you can give some insights from the 18 different occupations that you've been to, which is the media and everything else, which I never take at arm's length, let alone with a 10-foot pole, whether they're accurate or not. But the perception is that they're a bunch of hippies and trying to associate with these 1960s terms, and just trying to figure what your impression has been from the different places that you've gone to.
Well, you know, it's funny that, of course, there's lots of society includes lots of hippies, and of course, you know, there are going to be, you know, the people who are in a more marginal situation, like homeless or you know, basically, which, and of course, the homeless population would not mostly be characterized as hippies, but, you know, there are a fairly significant number of people who would fall into both the category of hippie and homeless. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so naturally, in a lot of places, especially in more impoverished cities, which the U.S. is full of, you know, the population of, you know, the people making up the encampments are certainly disproportionately homeless. And sometimes a majority homeless, like, you know, at least late at night in places like Detroit and St. Louis. I would say that when I was there, that, you know, at least probably, you know, it's at least 50-50 people who had been homeless before they started living in tents in the city. But of course, that's perfectly sensible that these camps should include a lot of folks, you know, who are really marginal financially, you know, because that's you know, that's part of the whole demand, the whole problem, you know, with the concentration of wealth. But the other thing is that, you know, I was just hanging out, staying with a friend in Montreal, in Walter, who was, among other things, in Tiananmen Square in 1989 for several weeks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was commenting to me about how, you know, basically, you know, revolution is a dirty process. I mean, it just physically, like, you know, the occupation of Tiananmen, as in many other, you know, occupations around the world today, in the Arab world, in the U.S., wherever, you know, there are not, there's not usually running water and other facilities for keeping clean. So if you weren't crusty before you began the occupation, after you lived in a tent for a few weeks, you know, you're going to blend in a lot better with the crust.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you for that insight. I was going to say the one thing that was really interesting about the music that you release is actually something that I'm not sure how many of our listeners would actually know, which is that it's under a Creative Commons license. And I was wondering if you would want to comment, like, talk about what that is and why you use it.
The Creative Commons idea is the idea of basically, well, there's different sort of within Creative Commons, technically, I guess there's different ways to register your music, but the basic idea is to make it more freely available philosophically, it also is partly the idea of, like, you know, what is original anyway, you know, and isn't there a better way that we can do things, you know, as a society, to allow lots of people to, maybe make a living in one way or another, like artists and scientists and whatever, without necessarily, creating this whole system that just mainly hampers creativity while giving some corporations lots of money and leaving most other people, not making a living, such as the case for sure with artists and musicians. But for me, in terms of giving away all my music for free on the web, actually, even though, it is the best way to get your music out there because we've never been able to rely on the record industry. Certainly since the 1970s, it's been just terrible. And before that, there were independent FM stations and there was some, more possibility in the U.S. of actually getting airplay and sort of working with the conventional system. But that's just it's just like a joke now. It has been for decades. There's mm-hmm. no real possibility for the vast majority of musicians to work with that. So, I mean, what the internet and Creative Commons and free downloads has represented for most musicians, whether or not they know it, is it's given them exposure they never would have had otherwise. Mm-hmm. And people complain about it, but the people who are complaining about it are mostly people who never would have been making a living under the old system mm-hmm. either. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're not making a living now, so they complain about it. But or they are making lots of money and they're complaining about it because CD sales are down for multi-million-dollar operations like Coldplay and Oasis and whatever. They're all making less money than they did 10 years ago, and that's who cares? But the thing is, for most musicians who don't get and never have gotten conventional media, this is a great way to get music out there, and by getting your music out there and having more fans, you can actually make a living. At least I don't know how it is necessarily going to play out for other, it's different for everybody. I don't think there's a one size fits all solution to, the various problems that are involved with the whole question of Creative Commons and copyright law and patent law and all that kind of stuff. But I think for musicians, more fans generally represents more gigs and more audience, and you make a living that way. There's different ways to work it with. I mean, I think in terms of journalism and the problem represented by Creative Commons, for journalism and represented by the internet, it seems like the model that most British newspapers are working with of having an sort of endowment, that's a really nice way to go, if you don't have to rely on sales of newspapers, because obviously, with the internet, newspaper sales are not going to be a thing of the future, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me briefly, just as you were talking about getting your name out there and getting your music out there to everybody, it reminds me back in the day, I can't believe I just said that, of when Napster was around. And mm-hmm. I was attending Northeastern University, which is where Sean Fanning created Napster when he created it. And I mm-hmm. just remember it just hampering our network and never being able to actually get anything productive done besides downloading music. There were a lot of people that were really in support of it, but there didn't seem to be at that time a license that would – obviously the record industry didn't want to do it because they just saw sales as plummeting and just didn't see it. But there were a lot of musicians that I ended up following that were utilizing that. And I was impressed because they were ones that were saying, oh, please download it, get it for free. There's mm-hmm. no other way that I can be heard on these corporately owned networks. And it's really interesting just hearing that same idea. Is like Creative Commons seems to have made it the preferred or the legal way, I guess is the better way of saying it, of sharing music.
It seems counterintuitive to give stuff away for free. It doesn't seem like a conventional business model, but clearly in the era that we're moving into, it works very well for some people at least. And I hope that we do move into a gift economy of some kind.
Well, I mean, for musicians, I think it works because most musicians make a living as performers, if they make a living at all. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be from, CD sales that you make a living. So generally, so there's that, way to work with the whole thing. I don't know if that applies to all other professions that are affected by this whole phenomenon, but it is nice that Creative Commons exists as a legal-ish kind of way to register music and to express your support for this idea, you know, for sure, that rather than just, because people still, the record industry has really scared a lot of people off from downloading stuff. I mean, you know, people kind of think they don't know where the legality is, and some people just avoid doing it because of that, which is, you know, I don't think works to our advantage, but hopefully most people don't care and they just download it anyway.
That's true. And I think there are some musicians out there that ended up, I think even actually is when I went to see Billy Bragg once, he said that he doesn't make money selling music anymore. It's mostly through his t-shirts.
and that's apparently true with a lot of, I don't do t-shirts either, so I don't know. But yeah, it's, and of course, you know, lots of musicians, including Billy Bragg, see the sense of the whole free download phenomenon in terms of getting their music out there. And mm-hmm. But of course, you know, there's a fair number of people in the music business who are still, you know, very loudly complaining about the whole thing.
Of course. Was it Metallica that was complaining in the beginning?
Yeah, well, they still are, I think. Yeah, Metallica, and I can't remember. I always forget who else, but there's a whole bunch.
I feel
really sorry for Metallica, just working so hard for all those years and, you know, now being completely broke and not having any money. It just seems so unfair on them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the music industry really has screwed a lot of musicians that even ones that are quite well known, and I, you know, I don't know specifically about Metallica and if they have any, you know, financial problems.
I think they're doing fine.
I mean, some other pretty well-known bands have had, like, you know, I remember hearing stories about, you know, people living in these fancy houses, and then they find out later that the houses are owned by the record
company. The record company, yeah.
Yeah, they hadn't paid attention to the contract, and they actually own nothing, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, that apparently happens, you know, but yeah, I think Metallica is probably doing okay. I mean, they still tour.
Yeah, that's true. I guess they do, huh? Well, and I mean, Creative Commons is clearly not just a musician's tool or community of sorts too, because it seems to be growing a lot. So there's a lot of abilities with it, which is really cool too. So now, so you tour a lot there, David, going around the country all the time. I never see you in one place, apparently, from your tour list at least.
Yeah, usually I'm roughly half the time on tour, and I kind of split my time touring really between North America, Europe, and Australia, New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of and then within Europe, mainly Northern Europe, mainly like, you know, Britain, Ireland, Scandinavia, Germany, but sometimes other countries too. So that's kind of my routine in a given year. Hmm. And it's a good routine, especially good to tour in Europe because, you know, Americans are, you know, generally broke, you know, and it's harder and harder to make much money touring in the U.S., actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you're giving your music away for free, how are you paying the bills?
Through gigs, getting paid to play, and then people buy CDs. Still, I have the music on CDs, and people buy CDs at shows. You know, pretty much like they used to. But definitely, you know, before the internet, and I, you know, I was touring for a few years before, you know, anybody was downloading MP3s. And the thing was that back then too, that you know, people in their 20s and teens did not buy a lot of CDs, you know, back then either, you know, and they don't now either. But they're broke. That's why, you know, they're all working minimum wage jobs if they're working at all, usually, you know, or they're in college and they don't have a job. You know, it's people buy CDs who are a bit older, you know, in their 30s and 40s and older, you know, that's my experience anyway. So, and people still buy CDs for some reason. They like to have things on CD. They're basically because they're lazy. I mean, you know, and they haven't figured out how to plug an iPod into their car stereo yet or something, you know, I guess. I don't know. Or they just want to have something physical or they want to give it away. I don't know. But they do still buy CDs. But mainly, now as before, mainly I make a living by getting paid to play gigs. People pay to come hear a show.
Nice.
You know, I don't do too many shows for free. You know, that's pretty much how I make a living, by doing shows.
David, because the show is cyber unions and we're kind of reaching out to labor movement people, I was just wondering what kind of interactions you have with unions, and do you belong to a union? What kind of interactions do you have? What kind of labor movement stuff are you involved in?
I belong to Local 1000 of the American Federation of Musicians and also the Industrial Workers of the World. And I work a lot with with unions all over, everywhere I tour. They're often, I mean, I'm often singing at labor events and at picket lines and working, for, unions, particularly outside of the U.S., but also sometimes inside the U.S. I mean, the labor movement, as you know, in the U.S. is represent a fairly tiny percentage of American workers, unfortunately. But in all the other countries I tour in, the labor movement is far larger and far more a part of society, and also frequently hosting cultural events of all kinds. And this is true in Canada and Australia and throughout Europe, And, to some extent it's true in the U.S., but to a much lesser extent. And the labor movement in the U.S. tends to be quite a bit more conservative in terms of what kinds of cultural events they're going to be hosting.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. that sounds great. I actually didn't know the exact labor union history of yourself, which is really cool. I think Walton is actually IWW as well, if I am correct.
Yes, and we have a lot of listeners in the show as well who are from both the IWW and the IWA. We got a shout out today actually from someone saying, "Don't forget the IWA." I think a German listener of a IWA affiliate listening to the show. So yeah, quite a lot of engagement from the radical unions.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. As there should be. I mean, of course, the labor movement is exactly where we all need to be.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's been great to see the labor support for the Occupy movement all over the world. That's been fantastic and really it's been pivotal. And it's really reminiscent of the labor involvement with the anti-capitalist protests in 99, 2000, 2001. That was, pretty well derailed by 9/11. But it's great to see the unions getting back involved with protesting things that like what's happening now.
Yeah, definitely. And it's actually, that was one of the things I was a bit concerned when the whole Occupy movement, Wall Street happened, was I was like, I didn't see labor right away, but then found out later that a lot of the people that were part of the organizing weren't necessarily using their labor affiliation, but they were connected to labor unions that were actively starting to organize these things, which is really encouraging and great to see.
Yeah, absolutely. All the people I knew in New York City who were there on the ground floor of the thing, came out of the anti-capitalist movement of 10, 11 years ago. And many of them, have been very much involved with labor organizing. And, Justin Melito was the first person I heard from about the protests. And he's a long-time labor organizer, as is Lisa Fithian, who was also one of the first people I ran into when I got to Wall Street. The most organizers on the planet.
That's great. That's great to hear. So I was going to say, just to, if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind giving you a bit of a plug on the Big Red Session promotion that you just sent out, if you want to talk about that real quick.
Oh, yeah. So if people go to my website at davidrovics.com, they'll see a link right on in the right there in the middle about helping to promote the new CD. And basically what I'm doing is for until the end of the year, I'm just selling the CDs for $5 each, and I'll cover the postage, but on the condition that people buy at least two and give away one to somebody in the media. And, the idea there is just to, basically get my fans, if they're, if they're able to spare $10 to help me promote the new CD, hopefully to an extent that would be really financially impossible for me to do just by hiring a radio promoter or something like that. And I have a little bit of prior experience with doing the same thing that I'm doing now, although thinking about it, I haven't really done it for 9 years, and I'm not quite sure why, but it worked out pretty well 9 years ago. That's because somebody knew Andy Kershaw and sent him one of my CDs. Andy Kershaw, who used to, and I think now again, has a popular world music show on BBC, and that was that was the best move I ever made. I mean, in terms of getting radio play.
Nice. That's great, David. I think that kind of wraps it up for the show today. I want to thank you a lot for taking the time to be on the show, and we'll put a link in the show notes to your website and with the promotion going on. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Good to talk to you, and greetings once again from Glasgow.
Yeah, greetings to Glasgow. I'll be there in the spring.
Oh, awesome. Look forward to it.
Thank you. Take care.
Right, cheers.
Bye.
Cheers.
Okay, so that was a really, really interesting interview. It's been quite long. I don't have anything else that I need to add this time. Do you?
No, not too much. Stuff that we'll probably touch on next week, but that's enough
okay.
for me.
Okay, good. I mean, I know that we've got a lot of ideas for future shows, and we'll be bringing them up regularly, and there'll be lots of interesting things to talk about. But I think that's everything for today. So once again, thank you for listening to Cyber Unions, and we'll see you next week.
See you all next week.
Where they buy the politicians, because this is where power has its seat, because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street, because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%, because these greedy banksters rob the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent. Because the last time that we had a decent government was about 1932. Because we the people are supposed to run this country, but instead it's all run by and for the few. Because now we know the rich do not pay taxes, but when they need a hand, it's us who bail them out. Because we suspected we lived in a plutocracy, but suddenly of late there is no doubt. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because both my parents lost their savings, because I have never opened an account, because the interest on my credit card just doubled, and now I can't pay the minimum amount. Because these budget cuts are just immoral, with our schools as overcrowded as they are, because there are no buses where I live, but I can't afford to drive a car, because so many of us don't have health insurance, the rest of us have it, but it sucks, because the rich are flying in their private jets, while the rest of us are slogging through the muck. Because capitalism isn't working, this system has just failed to produce. Because the 1% are prospering, while the rest of us just suffer their abuse. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because it has been demonstrated amply that the winners are the ones who stick around. Because this world should belong to everyone, not just the banksters who had smashed it to the ground. Because we've noticed voting doesn't change things when the politicians are mostly millionaires. Because we're learning how to stand up like Tunisians, like they did in Tahrir Square. Very young men. Muhammad was easy, struck a match that lit up all here, and all around the world the spell was broken, and a movement for the future was in birth. Because there's only so much the rich can feed us before we figure out which side we're on. Because we've learned if we want our liberation, it will only come if we stay here till the rising of the dawn. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because corporations are not people, and can't just let them choose. Because if we leave our fate to them, then all of us will surely lose. Because the climate clock is ticking, and we can't just leave our world behind. Because corporate rule isn't working, and it's time for humans' hearts and minds. Because you can't take it with you, because the rich just do not care. Because it doesn't matter how much you make, but how much you can share. Because these moments don't come often, because we want truly to be free. Because we know what really matters, something called society. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Stay right here. We're gonna 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 stay right here.